The Venturi's Voice podcast brings together some of technology's brightest minds to discuss all things leadership, technology, and staffing. Keep the conversation going in the Venturi's Voice Slack group and have the opportunity to meet some of our amazing guests. You can download Venturi's Voice via iTunes or via the Venturi Group website at venturi-group.com. Today's guest is Chris Astor, the Group Director of Architecture at Photobox Group. Mate, thanks for doing this. Looking forward to the chat. It feels like it's been a while actually since last time we spoke, but maybe it actually hasn't. I don't know. How long it's been, but it certainly feels that way. I looked at my calendar last week, and I thought that I was due to do it last week, and I was very excited. So you know when you think that it wasn't, it's like it's actually the next week, and then that also kind of creates the lag then, because then you're thinking, God, I've got to wait another week now to do this. So the build-up's been intense. So hopefully we live up to the expectation.
Hopefully, yeah.
mate, thank you so much. It's, last time we spoke, I think we probably could have recorded then. We covered, such a kind of wide array of things. And as always, when talking with people like you, it's I always find it so fascinating, because there's so much I want to talk about with people, because I'm such a nerd like that, that I always find that the hardest bit is kind of where to start. So I thought actually the appropriate bit would be to actually start from kind of the beginning with your regards, and thinking about kind of how you started out and also where you are now, but not specifically with your career, but actually with kind of the talent market. And how different that has been. I was talking actually with someone else from Photobox a few days ago, and we were kind of discussing about, traditional versus, non-traditional ways to kind of build up your skill set now. And obviously the kind of non-traditional way is being very much popularized with kind of, online educational programs and such. I'm not sure kind of what your progression was exactly. It'd be obviously be interesting to learn that, but just to think about that and now all the different ways that people are now acquiring skills, to be part of teams like yours now, do you ever think about that and think that how fascinating it is that it probably felt like it was a relatively small world, I'm sure, when you started off, to the point now where there's just so many different options and ways that people can acquire the appropriate skills?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, things have changed massively over the sort of 25, 26 years that I've been in work, if you like. My interest in computers and technology goes back way before that. I think, to probably the time when my dad first bought me a computer when I was 8, and I was probably hooked from that point onwards. Even back then I was like, well, how does this work? How can I program it? How can I make it do things that I want it to do rather than the stuff that you can get off the shelf? Mm. And that's sort of been everything, about my life since probably that point, right the way through, doing a computer science A-level, through doing a software engineering degree, at university, and right the way through, all of my career. So, just about the way I, I've always wanted to learn about, the latest and greatest, piece of technology, whatever that might be. I think it's interesting. I mean, even back in the early days when I used to, get together with like-minded people, and you're right, the group of people was much smaller. Today we would be called geeks. We weren't, I think we were called nerds back then. I think I'd probably prefer the word geek. We would get together and we'd design, solutions to problems, we'd make up problems, right? And design solutions to problems that technology could solve that maybe hadn't been done before. And it was great fun. And it's interesting because I think there's still those types of people out there. Even though, software development, technology, everything's become much more ubiquitous and people are joining from more professions, there are still those people out there that are the real geeks, the people that have always been into computers and technology in a way that maybe other people don't, and that they just understand how things work. And those are the types of people that I tend to sort of gravitate towards when hiring architects, because you want the people that really get some of the deep stuff around technology, not just, you know, the job where they come to work in the morning and leave in the evening, but the people that, you know, spend a lot of their free time thinking about and understanding new technology and playing with it and understanding how it works and working out how best to apply it to whatever the problem is that they're trying to solve today. Yeah. I think things have changed massively.
Yeah, it's interesting that, you know, a thought I had the other day was about, again, kind of the traditional versus non-traditional, just to put it into context. And that wasn't that's not necessarily the point that, you know, people are able to technically build the skills. And the question I kind of posed was, well, what skills are you able to learn in the traditional setting that you couldn't learn in a kind of non-traditional setting? And I was kind of being very bullish on, you know, the idea that, you know, the economics of university didn't make sense. And if you could acquire the skills online at much less cost, then why wouldn't you do that? And I suppose an interesting argument that someone made was that actually that's true. But now when you approach hiring technical people and architects and as such, you know, whatever their skills they have or whatever they're kind of sufficient at, inevitably that's going to change, and you don't necessarily need someone who is, you know, a very specialist in a particular language, for example, right? So you need them to be adaptive, be able to learn, you know, and probably be quite commercially minded and, you know, above all else, be good problem solvers. So it's not necessarily the case that they need to have the very technical niche skills anymore. So it's almost like it's kind of done, you know, a 360 where, you know, probably starting out, it was about learning a very specific technical language. And now you kind of have to be a bit broader and almost be kind of more commercially minded. Otherwise, you know, you kind of risk kind of pigeonholing yourself. So I thought it was an interesting argument, and kind of highlighted maybe the direction that, you know, a lot of technical careers are kind of going.
I think I agree that certainly, you know, the need to be more commercial, particularly in an architect's role, is important. But I think, you know, just going back to what university teaches you, which is not just the sort of technical skills. So, I mean, the programming languages that I learned at university were Prolog and Lisp and, you know, Modular 2 and OCaml and things which, you know, most of the listeners probably haven't even heard of. But what they taught me was that you needed to be able to learn a new language quickly, the principles behind different types of programming languages, whether they were functional or object-oriented. And those things have stood me in good stead as I then entered my career and, you know, then had to learn, you know, a new language, be that C++ or later Java, you know, much more recently JavaScript. So I think, you know, it does give you that grounding in your ability to learn and the teaching. And obviously there are many other benefits in terms of a decent social life at university as well. Mm-hmm. But I think you're right, going back to the commercial aspect, you know, being commercial and it's really important. And I, you know, with architects, I liken a lot of the architects and my role particularly is, you know, it's not just about technology. It's about having that commercial, you know, nous and understanding how to apply that. But it's also being a bit product manager. It's being a bit business analyst. It's being, you know, a bit engineer. It's applying all of those things, because often, as you say, it's about being able to solve a problem. And to be able to solve a problem, you need to have a customer hat and think about what the customer thinks. You need to be able to understand the data that you're seeing and what you're getting back. And you need to understand, you know, what technologies there are out there that might help solve that problem. You need to bring all that together and then add that commercial lens that says, okay, well, is this cost effective to solve that problem? And that's, I think, where we want to get to. Mm-hmm. There aren't, it's difficult to find that type of person. If I go back, I mean, a lot of my knowledge around or you know, around commerciality and other parts of the business have come. You know, I did an MBA, you know, distance learning MBA after I'd left university, and you know, that taught me again quite a lot. Again, it was more self-learning, although it was through through a university, but I wasn't on campus every day. So I think, you know, it's pulling all of those things together to be able to design, you know, commercially viable, customer-centric, and, you know, good engineered solutions to problems.
Yeah, good point. Good points. I do want to get onto the project that you're kind of working on at the moment, obviously over at Photobox. But just before that as well, scaling out projects, you know, obviously I know you've worked on kind of a variety of different size projects. Obviously what you're working on now is pretty large. You know, is it an obvious thing, and this might be a layman question, but, you know, it's coming from a layman, I suppose. But is it more difficult as the project scales? You know, the more expensive the project, the size of the project, is that kind of a given that they do become more difficult? Or is it kind of all varied, you know, based on, you know, a lot of different variables, I suppose? Is size what kind of adds the complexity to, you know, like an enterprise architect project?
Often, yes. I think, you know, scale makes a difference to complexity, and a lot of that complexity, I mean, some of that complexity is technical in the sense that there's lots of systems that need to be, you know, put together to work as a whole. But actually much more of it is probably organizational. And how do you get, you know, multiple teams to work in the same direction on different parts of the solution, but it working in the same direction to deliver that whole. And actually it's those organizational problems that are more difficult to solve and make it more complex, you know, in most situations. You know, I think so it's those, it's thinking about how you solve those problems, those organizational problems, and how you can do that through technology and how you can decouple systems so that teams can be less dependent on one another. But it's also about how do you set the broad direction of where you want to go to. And a photo box, so from an architectural perspective, the way we do a lot of that is through OKRs. So as an organization, we use objectives and key results as a way of setting our objectives and the results that we want to achieve from that. But we also use quite a lot of principles around the way we want things done, and underpin those with standards. So, you know, a lot of what we do as an architecture team is look at those principles, design that, you know, work on the standards that underpin them, and that gives the rest of the organization the objectives, so through the OKRs of what they want to achieve, and align those across the teams, and then the principles give them the ways of working, the how they should do stuff, and the standards, under, as I said, underpin that. And, you know, in, you know, how do you design a service, or how should you build an API, or how should you store your data, and what technologies can be used. So through those things, you can have a relatively large organization all working in the same direction to deliver the whole.
Interesting. And you know, how's the kind of the beginning of the project? You know, let's kind of get into it and talk about the kind of the Photobox project. So how do you even kind of start, you know, ground zero? You know, you're in control of the project. That probably seems like you're looking, you know, you're looking up at the top of Everest or something, right? I mean, that's the way I would kind of, you know, try and articulate it. Well, how do you even begin to kind of execute on a project at that scale?
So I think with something like the move to AWS that we've been doing, it, you know, it sort of started out with one of our core principles, which we started to talk about, which was that we wanted to move everything into the cloud. We felt that the cloud was where we wanted things to go. We had our own data centers that were, you know, costing us, you know, both money and from a capital perspective as well as an OPEX perspective, and resources to be able to maintain them. We said, well, we don't really want to be in the business of managing those, so we want to be in AWS. And so it sort of started from that vision of where we wanted to be. But then, you know, quickly, obviously, you can't just have a vision. You've got to, you know, work on what the plan looks like. And So we spent quite a bit of time, you know, getting people on board with the plan. You know, initially there were a number of people, particularly in some of our technical operations teams, who weren't necessarily on board with moving to the cloud. So there's quite a lot of you know, time spent, you know, educating people, helping them through this, having them on the journey of understanding why this is important, and getting them on board so that as we started to build the business case, you know, around the move, that they were going to be able to contribute to it and, you know, help us through that sort of ultimate sell to senior executives and get the sign off. And so that takes time, you know, bringing people on that journey. And so I spent quite a bit of time doing that, as well as, you know, writing the, you know, the business case. And, you know, we also use this project actually, interestingly, as a sort of as a showcase for a new way of working that we wanted to bring in, which was this concept of writing a press release. Now, it's an Amazon concept that we wanted to take, and you write an internal press release of what the world will look like when you finish the project. So it's a sort of one pager of the actual release, and you know, of how the world will be better within Photobox, how the world will be better with this project complete, and then you know, follow that up with a lot of questions, and then that helps you sort of refine the thinking and the story around why this is the right project. And you know, a lot of what goes into that is the modeling, right, in terms of, you know, how much things are going to cost, you know, how long the project is going to take, and what the timelines and the milestones, and potential solutions that you might have considered, potential providers. And initially we considered, you know, Microsoft and Google, as well as Amazon, as a provider for the project, and building out those pricing models and starting to get into negotiation, you know, in what that project would look like, and all along bringing along my fellow directors and some of their teams around, you know, what's necessary to deliver the project. And then once you get to the end of that process, you've got a press release, and you go through a few iterations generally with the C team around, you know, what that might, you know, they'll have more questions which you'll go through and answer, but ultimately you get to a point where you've signed off that business case, and then the real work starts.
And, you know, how involved do you kind of like to get from, you know, from the people side of things? You know, do you have, you know, do you like to kind of build the talent in yourself, or I suppose that's all subjected to, you know, what the project is and what the company is putting in place. But, you know, are there intricacies that, you know, you like to have that are in your control that you feel allow you to kind of properly execute to the best of your abilities?
Yeah, definitely. I think from an architectural standpoint, it's having that broad sort of overview of the architecture and the what it's going to ultimately look like. And we did quite a lot of that work with, you know, my colleagues in photo management here and in technical operations, about what that final architecture we wanted to get to would look like. But having somebody, you know, in the team, and actually on this project it was myself, but often with many of the other projects, it'll be one of the senior architects that I have in the team, you know, who oversees that the sort of broad technical design for that project, and, you know, and attending the weekly meetings, the monthly steercos, and making sure that what we're delivering is right. And then ultimately, as we work through the project, as problems come up, helping solve those problems, because problems always come up during you know, these types of projects. It's not as straightforward. You can't think through every problem that you're going to have before you start. And so you've got to have the right people in place to make sure that as and when those problems come up, you can work through them and solve them, you know, as quickly as possible to make sure that the project's a success.
Yeah. Was kind of agile when you were, I don't know when you kind of fully started embracing, you know, agile, but did that help or change things significantly, do you feel?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, when I started out my career, all the projects we did were waterfall. We'd have project managers, program managers, project office, you know, massive amounts of people that just updated Microsoft project plans. You know, and over the years, we've moved to Agile, and certainly the last sort of three companies that I've worked at have all been, you know, agile, and actually all three of them really early stages is moving away from waterfall and into agile, and it does help massively in some areas. I think what sometimes we lack a little bit is just some of that upfront thinking about what's necessary to get done. So when you start off a new project, you know, you can't just start and say, well, we're doing agile, and right, we'll work out literally week from week or every two week sprint, you know, what you're going to need to do. You need to have a broad sense of where you're trying to get to, both architecturally and time wise and scope wise, and also broadly how you're going to get there. Because I mean, if you can't do that, then often it's very difficult to sell something to senior management, to the C team. You know, they want to know how much things are going to cost. Mm-hmm. They want to know when they're going to deliver. And so you've got to have that sort of high level timeline sort of thinking before, but not going into so much detail as we would do. So, you know, in the waterfall days, you probably spend 6 months planning thinking about every different thing. And you know, so that the project could be, you know, planned out, you know, within, say, a 3 or 4 month period. Whereas we would go in and say, well, we'll spend a short period of time, 2 or 3 months, building the business case. We'll sign off, and then the project probably will take about the same amount of time, but we'll start earlier. We'll learn earlier. We'll find the problems, and we'll solve those problems as we go along. And you just got to make sure, as I was saying before, that the right team's in place to be able to solve them. So rather than have maybe a design team up front, we're doing all of that design work and then going on to something else and letting a delivery team deliver. It's making sure that that design team's still, you know, overseeing that project all the way through, which is very much what, as I said, what we did with this project, where, you know, we came up, you know, with a number of problems, particularly early on as we got our first snowball in, and quickly found that our network wasn't fast enough to be able to copy the photos, you know, off our own storage. Our own storage wasn't fast enough. And so we had to actually go through some more design work to upgrade our network, to change the way and the configuration of our big data arrays. I mean, these are like, you know, 10, 19-inch racks full of disk storage that we, you know, had to have some stuff reconfigured. We worked very closely with IBM and our CleverSafe consultants to get that done. So there was a lot of problem solving as we went along. And even once we'd solved some of those problems, we'd find other problems. So, you know, for instance, Snowballs is a good example. So the AWS Snowballs that we were copying the files onto. So Snowball is a 100 terabyte sort of ruggerized drive array, which you get from Amazon, and it plugs in to your data, and you copy data onto it. So it's got lots and lots of disk storage. And then you sort of post it back to Amazon, and they ingest all of that data into their data center. And these were originally designed for small numbers of large files. But we were transferring photos, and a typical size of a photo is somewhere between 1.5 and 2 megabytes. And so we were transferring very, very large numbers, 6.5 billion in total, of small files. And the Snowballs hadn't been designed for that type of storage. So we then had to work very closely with Amazon and with the team in America to have that optimized so that the Snowballs would work. And, you know, they were really supportive of that process, which was great, and really worked, you know, over a number of weeks to solve those problems. So it's all about how you solve those problems as you go along, I think, in the agile world, as opposed to trying to solve them all up front.
And, you know, one thing I was wanting to ask about as well is, you know, with the whole management of the projects, you know, this gratification from it is something that I was curious about, because I can imagine sort of when you were more hands-on, you kind of get that level of satisfaction from your work almost instantaneous, you know, from kind of day to day when you kind of solved a problem. Now kind of overseeing and managing the project, you know, there's obviously a different kind of set of a reward system there with it. When you started off managing projects in the scale, did that take some adapting? And you know, what are those kind of that you know, that gratification and that reward system? What is that for you now?
I think it probably has changed if I thought about it, but for me, it's still about delivery of whatever it is. And so, you know, whereas in the early part of my career, it would be writing some code and seeing that code being used in a live environment. Now it's about designing, you know, a solution and seeing that solution being delivered and working with the team to deliver that solution, or, you know, thinking about a, you know, a broad, you know, replatforming and getting the right people in place and seeing that sort of being delivered. And that, so ultimately it's the same thing. It's about seeing sort of your ideas being delivered. It's just the ideas get bigger. The more senior you get, the more experience you get, the ideas just get bigger. And so this gratification is the same, whether it's, you know, it's just about seeing what you built, what you designed, being delivered into, you know, into a live environment, if you like, and customers seeing it and being happy with it. So I actually don't think it's changed, but that much. It's just the scale at which, I guess, one operates.
Yeah. So you're still very much enjoying the work, I assume, then?
Yeah, I love it. I can't ever imagine doing something that's not technology related. Mm. As I said, I think because it's been part of my life, I mean, from such an early age, that, you know, it's just what interests me. And, you know, even when I'm not at work, you know, I'm often doing, you know, we might be playing with a bit of technology. I mean, maybe a bit less so these days because I've got a family and, you know, they get frustrated if I'm sat in front of a computer at the weekend. But you know, still always reading about the, you know, what's coming up, working out how we can use it, really even understanding how some of the stuff can work, you know, at detail, and doing proof of concepts of new technology. And even at Photobox, you know, I've been doing some proof of concepts around how we could build a particular type of event-driven architecture that would support a much faster website for us. So that was a few months ago. But so actually, even now, you know, and even in quite a senior role, I still like to be able to do some coding and understand how the technology really works, rather than just, you know, I'm very much against the type of architect that sits in an ivory tower and dictates how things to be, you know, should be delivered and what should be delivered. It's much more about, you know, the bringing the people along the journey and make sure all the teams, not just the architects, the engineering teams, understand the way we want to build our software, and help them, you know, and understand that, right? Because often these people have either, you know, they might have read about some stuff or they might not know about how we want to build our software. And so helping them to learn and to grow it also gives me a lot of satisfaction.
Amazing. Yeah. Well, it's awesome. Yeah. It's so empowering. People who work in technology, because it's most people, you know, I wouldn't say everyone, but most people, you know, are genuinely passionate about it. So it's got to feel, you've got to feel lucky, I suppose, to a certain extent, to have kind of had a career that is essentially doing something that, you know, you just genuinely have a passion for. There's very few people are probably lucky enough to do so.
Yeah, I feel very, very blessed in that sense, that I get to do the thing that I find, you know, the most enjoyable as my job every day. And, you know, yes, of course there are frustrations like there are in any job, right? In terms of problems that are really difficult to solve. But in general, it's brilliant. And I am lucky. And even many people that do, I think, you know, high-powered senior jobs, you know, in other professions, don't enjoy what they do as much as people in technology do. And so I feel very lucky that I get, you know, to play around with technology on a daily basis, you know, and get paid for it.
Amazing, mate. Amazing. Chris, I think we'll leave there. We're at half an hour now, believe it or not. So I think the fact that it's gone so quickly typically means that I've enjoyed everything that you've had to say. So, mate, I really appreciate you taking the time. I enjoyed the conversation. Yeah, hopefully we can do it again soon.
Great. Well, thanks very much, Andy. It's been really good fun.
Thanks for listening to the show. I look forward to hearing everyone's thoughts on this episode over on the Venturi's Voice Slack group. See you next time.